This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. I'm delighted now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Miko Peled. He's an Israeli writer and activist. He's author of the book, The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. He will be speaking on Thursday, November 5th at the Unitarian Universalist Congregation in Santa Fe, and then on Friday, November 6th at the First Unitarian Church in Albuquerque, both evenings at 7 o'clock. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So your father was a Zionist, he was a general in the Israeli army, and he was, as you write in the book, a hawk when he was young, but then worked for peace and advocated for the rights of Palestinian people when he was older, and he spoke fluent Arabic, he taught Arabic literature. A real change of heart. What was the cause of that change, do you think?
It's hard to say, of course, and it's hard to say whether or not it was a complete change of heart. You know, when he was asked that question, he would always say that there was no real change of heart, circumstances changed, and therefore we needed to do things differently. He claimed that before 1967, it was right to do one thing. After 1967, it was better to do something else. And then he thought after 1967 that the territories Israel took during that war, namely the West Bank and Gaza, should be given to the Palestinians to establish their own independent state so that they would, some of their, at least in a small way, their right to self-determination would be recognized and materialized. So that was his way of saying, or being pragmatic. You know, I don't know that it was, from his perspective, there was no big change, because strategically he thought the most important thing to maintain was to keep the state of Israel alive and in peace and safe, and the best way to do that is to make peace. And so he figured, we conquered almost the entire country. We can give up a few little pieces of land for the Palestinians because we have to somehow maintain a peaceful existence or coexistence with them. So that was kind of his rationale.
At the same time, you write in the book that he witnessed the aftermath of a horrible massacre by some Israeli soldiers of Palestinian people, and that although he never spoke about that to you, it seems to have affected him pretty deeply.
Yes, that's one that comes out. That's something that came out, or I found out really after the book was, you know, the manuscript was done, and I met a Palestinian gentleman who told me this entire story, and that's the one chapter before last in the book, a remarkable story about something that my father had witnessed, and many people thought that was the reason he became, you know, more lenient and more willing to accept the Palestinians and recognize the rights of Palestinians. Of course, whether this is true or not, 100%, we'll never know, but that's one possibility.
How did you begin your peacemaking work? Your family suffered a tragedy at the hands of a suicide bomber. How did your life change after that?
Well, my sister's little girl was killed in a suicide attack in Jerusalem, and I was living here in the U.S. already. I went back to Jerusalem right away and to my sister's apartment. And her reaction really is what kind of jolted me into activism. Activism in a way that, or with the purpose of ending the conflict, ending the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And that drove me. Her response was, you know, people always ask the questions, you know, how do we punish them, and how many of them do we kill in response, and how do we find the people who are responsible, and so forth. And she said very clearly, the people responsible are the Israeli government. They're the ones who are maintaining this brutal oppression of the Palestinians. They're the ones who have occupied Palestinian land, killing Palestinian children, arresting their fathers. You know, Israel has thousands of political prisoners. Palestinians have, you know, constantly live under a brutal, oppressive regime that is imposed by Israel. And she said, when you maintain a reality like this against another nation, then this is what you pay. This is the price that you pay. And in terms of revenge and retaliation, she said, I don't really want to hear anything about this. She said, no real mother would want to see this happen to any other mother. The idea that we kill people in response to somebody's death is absurd. And I'll have nothing, I won't have anything to do with it. And then, of course, the actual death of this wonderful little girl who I knew and loved. And then I came back to the U.S., and you can't just pretend like nothing happened and go back to work. And so I sought and found a group here in San Diego where I live. It was an Israeli-Palestinian or a Jewish-Palestinian discussion group. And that was my first exposure to Palestinians, even though I was born and raised in Jerusalem, which is supposedly a mixed city. But because Jerusalem is such a divided city, a segregated city, a very racist city, probably one of the most segregated cities in the entire country, I never met Palestinians. The Israelis never see or meet Palestinians because they live in completely different spheres. You've got the sphere of the master class, the oppressors, and the privileged, and then you've got the sphere of the oppressed, which is a completely different life and a completely different reality. So the two never mix. And here I was in San Diego for the first time, sitting in a living room with people, and you know, some of them were Palestinian, some of them were Jewish, and we had this conversation, and that's how I was exposed to Palestinian reality, really, directly for the first time. And then everything went on from there.
I mean, it's such an interesting book. I really loved reading it. I mean, it's a kind of a memoir, The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. And you describe, for example, the fears you had first going to that Jewish-Palestinian dialogue group in California, and then later when you're in Israel going to Palestinian areas there. Talk about that, if you don't mind, a little bit. Those fears, the source of those fears, how you dealt with them, how you overcame them.
Well, I didn't think I had any fears, so it really didn't present itself until I was actually in the moment, you know, about to knock on the door for the first time in a Palestinian home here in Southern California, finding myself then in a Palestinian city suddenly, which is 5 minutes from Israeli cities. I mean, the distances are very short because it's a very small country. And suddenly all the signs are in Arabic, and all the people are Arabs, and they don't look like me, and they don't talk like me, and they probably want to kill me. And then it's like these little demons just broke out of their little box or some little hiding corner, some corner they were hiding in my mind. And it happened again, and then it happened again, and it happened again for, you know, over time. And the process that I went through, that I was very fortunate to go through, was the process where I allowed trust to come in, and the trust pushed away the fear. So every time I allowed myself to take that step and to trust the people I was going to see and to trust the convictions that I had, I found that the trust pushed away the fear and allowed me, and now I travel to these places all the time. I don't have any fear at all. There's not an issue at all. But in the beginning, it was very, very, these little demons I had no idea existed, and they were very powerful and very loud. Very powerful and very loud. And there was a real sincere fear for that I was not going to be going home that day because all these Arabs, I mean, they obviously want to kill me because they can see I'm an Israeli Jew. It was that powerful.
And those fears and those kinds of attitudes are reinforced by people around you when you're in Israel. I mean, even people in your own family were saying, oh, my goodness, you're crazy to go over there.
Yeah, people still do. I mean, people still do. They always say, oh, you know, I was just there for 3 weeks. I was, you know, I spend most of my time in Arab East Jerusalem. I study Arabic there. I have friends there. I meet there people. I give lectures. You know, I'm there all the time. And there was, you know, there's this wave of unrest there right now that's been going on for a while, through the entire month of October. And I hear this all the time. Do you have to go there? Do you have to go there today? Do you have to, you know, if I go to a friend and I spend the night somewhere in the West Bank or in a Palestinian town somewhere else, it's always, well, do you have to spend the night? I mean, you know, it's dark and, you know. There are other people who say, aren't you afraid? Aren't you worried? Doesn't it make you nervous? And on the way back, sometimes this time it happened again. I was in Ramallah, and on the way back at the checkpoint, the Israeli police held me for a while because it's illegal for Israelis to go to major Palestinian towns. So on the way back, they check my ID, and they see that I'm an Israeli. So it's always, you know, are you out of your mind? Do you know what they can do to you? And then we're going to have to come and save you. You know, how irresponsible of you. That's the mentality of racism. It's the mentality of occupation. It's the mentality of oppression, that the oppressed are always seen as some kind of violent, irrational beings that we have to always make sure we protect ourselves against them, and we are safer among ourselves than among the other.
And it's ironic. I mean, you describe these confrontations that you have with police and with soldiers, in which you're saying, I was just treated very graciously by these people who you're so terrified of. Meanwhile, you have essentially kidnapped me and held me against my will for hours and hours. Who's the dangerous party here?
Yeah, that's exactly how it is. I was one of the reasons I was back there this time, because I had a trial for one of the arrests. I've been arrested several times, but one of the times I was arrested in the West Bank at a protest, they actually pressed charges, and the trial took place in October. Just a few weeks ago. The way the prosecution describes it is, you know, me and several co-defendants, other Israelis that were there, you know, we participated or we were in the midst of riots and incitement and, you know, unruly Palestinians throwing rocks and endangering, you know, everybody and so on. And then I described what actually took place. You know, these are very peaceful protests. These are very, you know, the idea of nonviolent resistance is embedded so deeply in Palestinians, is rooted so deeply in Palestinians. It's been part of Palestinian culture for a very long time. And now these protests on a regular basis, on a weekly basis, in several places every Friday. And the idea of nonviolence is just as important as the idea of resistance and freedom, which is why they're resisting. And so I explained this, and the judge looked at me, and he said, so let me get this clear. The officer who testified just before you described this riot with rocks and violence, you're describing this very peaceful march, almost kind of pastoral, you know, beautiful atmosphere. And then suddenly there was tear gas and the soldiers were shooting and so on. He said, is this really what you're describing? I said, this is actually exactly what I'm describing because that's exactly what takes place. So there's this attempt to always describe the Palestinians as violent, unruly, you know, their protests are not peaceful, their riots, you know. And then the Israelis come in because they have no choice because they have to, you know, stop this violence or whatever. And you say it enough times, people believe it, you know, and very few Israelis actually end up going there, so they don't know. But that's the reality. They always think that they are coming to save me somehow, and it always turns out that they do everything they possibly can to prevent Israelis and Palestinians from doing anything together.
Well, and there's also, I mean, all you really ever hear about in the media about Palestinians is suicide bombings. You don't hear that there's not only peaceful protests, but a culture and dedication to peaceful protest.
Yeah, that's. I mean, the vast majority of Palestinian resistance has always been peaceful. You know, out of, I don't know, what are there? There are about 6 million Palestinians in Palestine itself, and then there's another probably 5 or 6 million Palestinians in diaspora. There have been less than 200 cases of suicide bombings, which is a lot, but it doesn't reflect on the entire nation. It reflects on a particular situation, and of course there haven't been suicide bombings in many, many years. And the rest of the Palestinian resistance has always been and continues to be nonviolent. There's the movement, the BDS movement, which calls for boycott, divestment, and sanctions. It's principled, it's nonviolent, and it works. We've seen it work in South Africa. There are the peaceful protests in Palestine. There are student groups on campuses all over the U.S. that do fantastic work, Students for Justice in Palestine. You know, there's a lot of you know, Palestinians in Gaza who can't come out, but they can write and they can send videos and they blog and they discuss things and there's theater and there's a vast array of Palestinian resistance, which is not violent at all. It is very determined though. And Israel fears this determination because that determination is not going away. This determination means that the Palestinian resistance is going to succeed. Violent resistance is easy to kill.
Right.
But a determined resistance that is nonviolent and is principled is impossible to kill. And that's what Israel fears the most. And that's why it works so hard to always portray the Palestinians, regardless of what they do or where they are, as violent and non-trustworthy and so forth.
You wrote in your book, quote, Israel created an entire bureaucracy with the sole purpose of making the lives of Palestinians unlivable so that they will ultimately have no choice but to leave. Tell us a little bit more of what that looks like. What is life like for ordinary Palestinians in Israel?
If you try to describe a day in the life of a Palestinian, nobody would believe you because it is so horrible. There's not a single activity where they don't have to either meet or be questioned or ask to collaborate with Israeli security services. Now, inside the state of Israel, what you know, the Palestinians who live in communities where they are actually citizens of the state of Israel, they live under the special section of the Israeli secret police, the Shabak, which governs their lives completely. And so the laws that govern and the reality that governs their life is entirely different than the lives of Israelis who are, or Jews who are Israeli citizens. Then you've got the Palestinians in the West Bank, and again, depending on where they live, that will determine the exact laws by which they live. The West Bank is divided into area A, B, and C. Jerusalem is a whole other entity. The Palestinians who live in Jerusalem have no citizenship or identity at all. They are considered alien residents. And that can be taken away from them very quickly if they go out of town, if they go overseas to school for any length, any period of time, that is taken away from them and their homes are taken away. And again, the Palestinians in Gaza have really no rights at all. Israel comes in and bombs and kills there, you know, at will. So it's impossible to describe it because it is, first of all, it differs from place to place because the bureaucracy that Israel created has created different laws for different people, for different Palestinians, depending on where they live exactly. And that determines who they can marry. That determines where they can live. That determines how far they can travel. That determines where they can go within the country. That determines whether they can use Tel Aviv Airport or cannot use Tel Aviv Airport, but has to go to Jordan if they want to go overseas. It determines the amount of water that they get. Even though Palestinians make up more than half of the population in the entire country, Palestinians are allocated only about 3% of the water in the country. So the larger portion of the population, over 50%, only gets 3% of the water in the country. And it goes on and on and on in every aspect of life. No Palestinian has ever been given a permit to build anything. So if they want to add a portion to their house, add a balcony, I don't know, build another story for their children, in almost 70 years, no permit has ever been given to any Palestinian to build anything. Of course, Israelis can build and do whatever they like. It's an entirely different life if you're an Israeli Jew, not to mention job opportunities and higher education and all of that kind of stuff. It's beyond. The only way to describe it is to call is apartheid. It's really the only way to describe it, or perhaps Jim Crow, if you want to use a term that's closer to Americans.
Right, right. I know. I was thinking about racism in the United States, attitudes between black and white people here, and also of Native American people whose land was taken away, and you talk about in your book how you are very much in favor of a one-state solution, and I was wondering if you could tell us about your reasoning for that and the kind of pushback you get from other Jews, from other Israelis when you talk about that.
Well, the idea that there's an option between a one-state solution and something else is a myth. Israel conquered the entire country in order to establish a state for Jewish people over the entire country. So the larger portion of the country was conquered and occupied in 1948. Two areas that Israel decided not to take in 1948, which are the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, that are areas that were created by Israel, they took 20 years later in 1967. And that was it. They took the entire country and they built for Israeli Jews and they built cities and towns and brought Jews to live everywhere. And everything was built for Israeli Jews only. Exclusively. So they created a state with exclusive rights for Jewish people, even though it's an Arab country, and even though the majority of the people who live there, certainly today, are Palestinian Arabs. So it's not like there's an option to divide the state or to keep it as it is. It is a single state. It is a single state. There are Palestinians who live everywhere. There's not a single part of the country where there are no Palestinians. You know, half of Tel Aviv is Yaffa, which is an old Palestinian town. There are, you know, tens of thousands of Palestinians there. There are Palestinians in the north, in the Galilee. There are Palestinians in Jerusalem, of course, in the south. There are Palestinians everywhere. So, and the proximity between Palestinian towns and Israeli towns, even though there's very, very effective segregation geographically, they're very close. You cannot delineate an area and say this is only Palestinian. There's no such place. And so, from any point of view, look at it's impossible to divide the country, and there's no reason to do it either. Just like apartheid had to come down in South Africa in order for the rights of black South Africans to be recognized, the state of Israel as a state that offers exclusive rights to Jewish people has to be replaced with a state that is democratic and recognizes the rights of all people and allows one person, one vote, democratic one person, one vote, free and fair elections to everyone. and created a government and a state that represents all the people. Now, Israelis, we're like the whites in South Africa. We are colonizers. We didn't immigrate there. We came to colonize. But today, you know, here we are. There's about almost 5.5-6 million Israelis living there. Palestinians, of course, are the majority. There are over 6 million Palestinians there now, living there. They are the natives of the land. It's always they've always been there. This is their country. It's Palestine. So the only way to move forward is to undo what is existed today, which is basically an apartheid regime that favors Jews for some reason, to a state that recognizes that everybody has rights and all people are deserve the same recognition, the same rights, and the same. And so forth. And that's the only way to do it. That's the only way to move forward. Recognizing the state of Israel or supporting the state of Israel or accepting the state of Israel means accepting a racist, violent, apartheid regime that will never allow the Palestinians any rights and never recognize the rights of Palestinians. And that's absurd. That is not something that's sustainable.
Yeah.
You know, the Gaza Strip is five minutes from Israeli towns, and there's a humanitarian catastrophe taking place there. You know, you can't stay like that forever.
Well, I mean, when you talk to both Israeli and American Jews about that, at least in my experience, they say, but you need to have a Jewish state. And there, people are very attached to that idea. And maybe you can tell us why. But, I mean, what you're asking for and what you're working towards seems to require such a massive change in attitude. First of all, a willingness to give up the idea of a Jewish state, a true belief in equality, a willingness to share the wealth and a willingness to be governed equally, and especially given all the years of illegal settlements, the rightward drift of the country, and the unwavering support of the U.S., no matter what Israel does, how do you see that transition?
Through resistance. You know, whites in South Africa didn't give up their privilege because they woke up one day feeling, gracious and generous. They had no choice. South Africa was isolated. There were boycotts put in place, sanctions put in place, and there was no choice. So one day, the president of South Africa stood up and said, we're releasing Nelson Mandela and calling one person, one vote elections, and that was the end of apartheid. He didn't do it because he suddenly felt generous. No, you know, Americans in the white didn't, you know, Jim Crow didn't end because whites in the South here in the U.S. suddenly felt some kind of love for blacks. They had no choice. That's how it's done, through resistance. That's why resistance is such an important part of this. You know, that's why BDS, boycott, divestment, sanctions, is so important. That's why it's important to isolate Israel. That's why it's important to always confront Israeli representatives, Israeli ambassadors. Any representatives of the state of Israel need to be confronted with this. There has to be a sense that resistance is the only way, because that's the only way we get justice. No privileged group ever gave it up. I don't see a situation where some of the Israelis or American Jews, those who support Israel, suddenly wake up one day and feel, you know, are convinced that justice should reign. That never happens. That is why you have resistance. And the power, like I said, of the Palestinian resistance today is so strong and so principled and so determined that it is inevitable that it will succeed. Israelis will wake up one day and see that it's over, just like a wife in South Africa. And in South Africa, woke up one day and realized that apartheid is over and they can either leave or accept it. And I think the Israelis will have the same choice. If they don't like living in a state where there's equality, then they can go somewhere else. If they don't like living in a state with Arabs, with Palestinians, they need to go to a different country, because in that particular country, the majority of the people are Palestinian Arabs. And this is very simple. They don't have to be convinced. They'll wake up one day in the morning and that's going to be the reality. That's how it works.
In South Africa, in the case of South Africa, the movement to boycott was very powerful. And you talk about boycott, divestment, and sanctions, which does not, at least at this point, seem to quite have reached that kind of power. I mean, what kind of leverage do you see that it would take, or that's happening, or that could happen, to really move the power dynamics?
You know, in South Africa, you know, the United States, of course, was the last one to boycott and to accept the boycott. And it was in the late 80s. And by even at that late in the game, nobody thought that apartheid would ever fall in South Africa. In 1994, Mandela was already president of South Africa. So things moved very quickly. And I think we're at that point now where, you know, there was an article recently Israel has, you know, Israel's largest largest piece of the Israeli economy is its arms sales and manufacturing of arms. And there's been something like a 40 to 45% fall in sales of arms. People do not want to buy Israeli weapons anymore because it's tainted, because it's bad politics, because they get protesters all the time. Major arms manufacturing countries did not come and participate in you know, Israel had like a military show where they demonstrate all of their things. You know, they didn't participate. Even countries who are very close to Israel, allied with Israel, European countries. So that's huge. From something like from 2012 until now, a reduction in about almost 40 to 45% in its arms sales. And we're talking about many billions of dollars. We see banks and trade unions and so forth divesting from Israel and ending their business and ending their transactions with Israeli banks and with Israeli companies. This is a process that's been going on and is going to continue to go on. There's a huge Israel was almost kicked out of FIFA, out of the you know, soccer World Cup, and now there's a huge push to kick Israel out of the Olympics coming up in Brazil. These things never work fast enough, and they're never strong enough. You know, Palestinians are suffering every single day. Palestinians in Gaza, you know, over the last month, I don't know how many Palestinian children Israel killed and injured. In Gaza last year, they murdered over 2,000. So it's too late for those people. But the push to bring about or the successes of the BDS, as we see them developing, you know, are growing all the time, and they're having an impact. It's not something you see on the front pages of the New York Times yet, but we are in the process. And that's how you do it. You know, South Africa was a strong country. They had nuclear weapons. They had the full support of America. Ronald Reagan refused to boycott them. And yet, you know, like I said, by 1994, Mandela was already president.
Yeah. Miko Peled is an Israeli writer and activist. He's author of the book, The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. And once again, he will be speaking on Thursday, the 5th of November, at the Unitarian Universalist Congregation in Santa Fe. And then on Friday, the 6th of November, at the First Unitarian Church in Albuquerque. It's at 7 o'clock in both places. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to Studio X for their technical support and web design.